here on Real Liberty Media. I'd like to invite you to listen to some other shows here on Real Liberty Media. We have Behind the Woodshed, evolutionarily engaging in counter-propaganda tactics and related work with Hal Anthony. We also have It's All Connected with Grimner and Circle. They connect all the dots. The subject doesn't matter. The connections are real and tangible. Also, we have Free Your Mind with Grimner and Moose Girl. You can break from thought constraints on the scope of your vision only by realizing those limits that have been presented to you do not apply to you. They are not real. Those concepts make people feel comfortable by giving them thought boundaries. This is the Free Your Mind show with Moose Girl and Grimner. Sit back and listen and see your way beyond the world as it has been defined. We have A Pondergander with Vin E. To Think and Reason, Raising Expectations Through Thought-Provoking Episodes. If you cannot do great things, do small things in a great way. On Sundays, you can sit back and relax and enjoy some music from Grimner. He broadcasts the Sunday Blues Show live on Sundays from noon to 3 p.m. Eastern Time. He plays all kinds of blues, from great oldies like Robert Johnson, Howlin' Wolf, and John Lee Hooker, to the most modern hard-rocking blues from Joe Bonamassa, Poppy Chubby, and Samantha Fish, and all the stuff between, like Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jack Bach Project, and Gary Moore. He also plays blues music from classic rock bands, the Rolling Stones, ZZ Top, and Cream. And while he's playing the music, we are in the Real Liberty Media chat on irc.freenode.net playing a rousing game of trivia. So come on over and join us every Sunday for some great tunes, fun trivia, and great chat. We also have a show, The Top 10 Countdown. Gary L. and Gigi's Boo play the top 10 songs from years gone by, and they provide some interesting historical facts and trivia about the songs and the era. These are all great shows with great content and inspiring messages. Come spend some time with us. Get to know us, and we will get to know you. Also, if you love what you hear and want to represent, we have Real Liberty Media here. You will love the artwork and it will inspire conversation. Check out our Amazon.com store and Real Liberty Media goods from our website, reallibertymedia.com. Hello, this is Doc Mike the Redneck Dentist. It's a Tuesday. We're doing a live show here Tuesday evening. Unless you're listening on podcast, then it's whenever it is. But thank goodness for Real Liberty Media. What a great site. Great shows here. You heard the commercials. Check them out. I was just listening live to the site. If you just hit the listen live button, you'll hear either somebody doing a live show or you'll hear a rebroadcast of a previous show, and that was Moose Girl and Grimner from March, I think, May of 20, I don't know, it was last year sometime. Anyway, really fantastic shows on there, great information, entertaining always, no matter who you're listening to, and pretty educational too. Hey, speaking of educational, I just want to throw this out there real quick. There's an old video game called Psychonauts. I don't know if any of you have ever played it. I mean, I'm kind of a gamer, but I don't know why I'm bringing this up, but it's an interesting game about like what goes on in your mind. And as I was playing it, it kind of occurred to me that it's kind of educational, especially for, I would say, younger people. It kind of really explains what's going on in your brain during different things like stress or fear or, I don't know, it was kind of surprising because the game was released in 2005 and it didn't do really well right off the bat. So, you know, I think the company moved on to something else or maybe just quit making video. I don't know what they did. But what was funny is, over time, this game kind of got a following, and like more and more people would play the game, and it kind of grew into a huge community. Well, so in 2017, that company put out another small kind of addition to the game, and it was a VR game, virtual reality. And I guess it did okay, but the fans really wanted a follow-up. And so the company kind of started a crowdfund, and you know, the fans kind of pitched in, and they made another Psychonauts, and it's coming out either this month or next month. I don't know. It's coming out sometime this year. So if you have younger people in your family and they like to game, you might want to recommend that game to them. I mean, it's a pretty fun game. The graphics of the original game are like 17 years old. So, you know, it's not like the graphics you get in today's games, but it is, you know, it's pretty fun, entertaining, great characters. It was well written. Maybe consider checking that out. All right. Hey, so did you guys see this? If you didn't see this, you need to go check this out. But there's a teenage girl in some part of California. I don't know if it's southern or northern. It doesn't matter. It was in California somewhere. And this mama bear and her cub were kind of getting into this young girl's backyard. And it kind of looked like she let her dogs out. And the dogs, of course, charged over to the bear, which was on a fence. And I don't mean like a wooden fence. It was more like a brick or block fence. And, of course, that bear was trying to protect its cub. So it was kind of swatting at these dogs. And at one point, it actually kind of hooks one of those dogs. And That teenager, like, she was probably 15, 16, I don't know. She didn't look like a 13-year-old. She freaking charges up to that fence and shoves this freaking bear off the fence. I'm telling you, it was pretty damn amazing. So if you didn't see that, man, go have a look. Oh, and then the girl gathered up her dogs. I think there were three dogs, two little ones and then one mid-sized dog, like a retriever or something. She gathers the one up that the bear kind of had hooked and got them all headed back to the house. But man, that was really something to see. And just amazing. I don't know. Oh, that's good. Somebody posted it in here. That's awesome. You need to, if you didn't check it out, go check it out. And maybe I'll put a link in the show notes, but I kind of wasn't really thinking about talking about that. But so it's not in the show notes yet. I'll go look for a video and put it in the show notes. So if you're listening to this later, hopefully you could go find it on whatever, you know, platform it'll show up on. Okay, so something I heard this morning really kind of blew me away. As you know, if you've listened to me a few times, you know I'm not crazy about solar power or wind power because they just don't pencil out very well. I think as supplemental power, you know, for like a homestead or living off the grid, you might be able to make kind of a combination of that with fossil fuels work. But here's something I heard today that just blew me away. And it was this guy in Colorado. I'll try and put the story back together as I'm thinking about it. Okay, but the bottom line is, this guy said it takes 100 tons of fossil fuel. No, he said there's 100 tons of fossil fuel in each wind turbine. Now, I'm not talking about a little windmill you put on your property to generate power. I'm talking about those big wind turbines that you have, like here in Oregon in the Columbia River Gorge, or in Southern California on the mountains down in Southern California, what they're called, Sierra Nevadas maybe. But I don't know if they're actually on the Sierra Nevadas, but, you know, on some of the coastal ranges or foothills in California, you get a lot of those. Is that right, Grimner? A lot of wind farms out there in what, New Mexico and Texas. So check it out. 100 tons of fossil fuel in each wind turbine. So even if you wanted to be solely dependent on wind turbines and solar panels, you're still going to have to use fossil fuels because that's what they're made of. 100 tons in each wind turbine. As far as I know, they don't have a substitute for that fossil fuel that they're putting in the wind turbines. And as I've said many times, and I actually have an update this week about the solar panels being made, you know, by slaves in by Uyghur Muslim slaves in China. And it's, you know, again, to me, it's just like the whole hypocrisy thing. It's so amazing to me that we don't learn our lesson. You know, here we are always talking about, the past year and a half, Black Lives Matter and this whole kind of restitution thing going on. And yet we still have companies based in the U.S. that are doing business and having really successful businesses by using slave labor from China. So it's kind of strange, you know, that we talk about how horrible slavery was, but we don't really address it in a realistic way. Like, okay, if you know, all those companies, Nike, Microsoft, Samsung, Apple, the list goes on. I think last episode I read not the whole list, but a significant list of companies that use that slave labor or use products from slave labor from China. And then they try and, that's true, we're all slaves now. And then they try and, you know, be the moral representative of to the world, but yet it's pretty hypocritical that, you know, on the other side they are benefiting from slave labor. So the update is on that very thing, forced labor and clean energy. I'm going to read a little bit from this. It says, China dominates the global supply chain for solar power and is the leading exporter of solar panels and critical components for making solar panels. For instance, about 95% of solar modules rely on one mineral, solar-grade polysilicone, and China produces 80% of the world supply of polysilicone. And just while I'm thinking about that for a minute, you know, with all the green energy talk and how much environmentalists complain about damage to the environment, here you have to mine polysilicone. So just as you have to mine pretty much every other mineral that you need to produce things, it requires mining. So, you know, again, it's kind of another kind of point of hypocrisy for me that, you know, people who believe in solar power and, you know, all this green energy, they really are so shallow because they have no idea what it takes to produce like the solar panels. And they don't have any idea where those solar panels are coming from. Or maybe they even do. Maybe they hear that, you know, they're made in China and that's all they know is, oh, it's made in China. And maybe, you know, because I don't really follow the kind of industrial commercialization of solar energy. Maybe they talk about how, you know, China's the leading producer of these solar panels, but they never mention that they're the leading supplier because they use slave labor. You know, and kind of on another note, I was thinking about this. I guess maybe these things could be tied together. I actually should maybe finish this story first or not. I don't know. I'll finish this story and then I'll come back to what I was going to say. So it says Xinjiang alone is responsible for 45% of the world supply of polysilicone. Such a high level of production requires a significant supply of labor. In the Sheffield Hallam University report titled In Broad Daylight, Uyghur Forced Labor and Global Solar Supply Chains shows how China's booming solar industry has been tainted by the forced labor of Uyghurs and other minorities in Xinjiang. And it just goes on to say, researchers learned that Chinese government agents or labor recruiters would go door to door to each Uyghur or Kazakh households, assigning everyone a numeric value and one of three categories called controlled, general, or assured. The points and the categories would determine where each person would be placed for work. No one was exempt. Anyone who hesitated would have to endure daily visits or harassment until they relented. Those Uyghurs or Kazakhs who already had family members in internment camps were told that their participation in the work placement program would help speed up the release of their imprisoned family members. Yeah, I'm sure it would. Basically, the government made an offer that no one could refuse. Once in the programs, minority workers were under constant threat of internment, so they couldn't walk away from a job they didn't want in the first place. Researchers identified at least 11 solar companies that directly engaged in forced minority labor transfer in Xinjiang. In addition, about 90 Chinese and international solar companies' supply chains are affected by forced minority laborers. For example, all four of Xinjiang's polysilicone manufacturers, and it lists them out, have reported their participation in the Chinese government's labor transfer programs or are supplied by raw material companies that have. So, again, you know, what's kind of interesting to me that, so the original report by that Australian company that I talked about, I think last week, you know, enlisted all those big, powerful, successful companies in the United States, or I should say in the world. And you haven't heard any of them come out and say, okay, we've quit using that labor system, or we've quit using products that come out of that forced labor system. But what you do see them doing is talking about how unfair, you know, voting rights in Georgia are, or how, you know, Black Lives Matter, or how we all need to be more forgiving and more accepting of everything else in the world, and how slavery was bad. And you hear all of this kind of righteous talk from them, and, you know, their kind of public posturing to make it look like they give a crap, but their actions, I think, speak louder than their words, because none of them have come out to say, none of them have come out to say, yeah, we're not using that, you know, that supply chain anymore. Or, you know, like some of these companies that make electric cars, you know, they came out at one time and said, oh, we don't use cobalt from mines where children are forced into labor. And that's not necessarily in China. It's somewhere else. I think South America or somewhere is the leader of cobalt production. But you don't hear any kind of, you don't hear any of that kind of talk from these major companies. And it really kind of, I guess, I would say it bums me out, but it doesn't really bum me out. I mean, I was going to say I don't care, but I must care because I keep going back to it. But I think what bothers me the most is just how hypocritical these big businesses are. And I believe the reason is because nobody knows the rest of the story. Nobody knows. Nobody goes into depth. You know, when you're using your little iPhone, you know, and it's the greatest thing that, you know, you think has ever been created, you don't understand that that iPhone was created by, you know, at least parts of it by slave labor. You don't understand that the batteries that we make today with cobalt in them for cars, for solar energy storage or wind power storage of energy, you don't understand, or people don't hear that, yeah, kids were forced into labor, and if they got injured, well, there's no like OSHA regulations or whatever to protect children. And the companies that are making the money, I really don't believe that they care. They only care when somebody actually makes it public. And then I think they do everything they can to you know, reduce the harm that those kind of reports would do. Like initially, you can see a lot of these companies, initially when this report came out about slave labor in China, these companies said, oh, we don't have anything to do with that. Well, until they kind of saw that the report and the research was, you know, much deeper and well documented, so that they couldn't really deny that they knew they were getting products from places that were using slave labor. And then you heard a little bit of kind of backstepping, you know, but nobody still denying that that they are using products from those slave labor camps, or basically from communist China. Drink time for everybody. Oh. Something else I was going to say, you know, last week I was talking about how there wasn't really, there's not a shortage of gasoline. There's plenty of gas, plenty of fossil fuel. There's not a shortage of electrical energy. There's plenty of electrical energy. But a lot of these things that, you know, there's suddenly a shortage of, it isn't because it can't be produced. It's because governments, especially the U.S. government, is preventing us, those companies in the United States who would like to produce electricity, who would like to produce gas, who would like to produce lumber. The federal government has interfered with that so much, they're the ones putting the restrictions on whether or not there's going to be energy, whether or not there's going to be fossil fuel, whether or not there's going to be lumber products. You know, here in Oregon, it's the most ridiculous thing. I did grow up in a logging town. Springfield, Oregon, basically, it's kind of funny. Eugene and Springfield just are separated by a river, kind of, the Willamette River. And when I was growing up, like the Eugene people always called us rednecks, those of us who lived in Springfield. And because Springfield was kind of known as a logging community. So if you lived in Springfield, by association, you were a logger. And if you lived in Eugene, by association, you were kind of like a preppy, you know, or you were like kind of uppity. You were the rich people on the other side of the river. And, you know, Oregon had done such a great job. Okay, I will admit this. Before there were regulations, we destroyed some awesome old growth forest. Like, you know, like you would cut down one tree and it would fit on a log truck. You like one log would fit on a log truck. Whereas now, when you see the logs on a log truck, there's 15 or 20 logs on a log truck. That's because we were cutting down these gigantic old growth timbers. And you might say, you know, the environmentalists would say how horrible that was, that we destroyed this old growth timber, blah, blah, blah. You know, the thing is, it was a commodity that we needed. And we got smarter as time went on. My point was that Oregon is actually awesome at making, at replenishing, reforestation. So when you clear cut an area in Oregon, when you take out timber in Oregon, you know, you're required to replenish it, but it only makes sense to replant those trees anyway, because that's your livelihood. Loggers don't want to ever run out of product, you know, and it only takes, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. I know I say only, but in 30 to 50 years, you can have harvestable lumber, I mean trees, to make lumber with. And yeah, it's not old growth lumber, you know, it's, you know, it takes 20 trees to fill up a log truck, but you know, it's renewable, and it's a great renewable resource. You know, when loggers go in and clear cut an area, it kind of opens up new hunting area for hunters, or new grazing area for wildlife, new habitat. Yeah, it destroys some habitat and it creates new. The whole environment is renewable. But Oregon's done a great job at that. And I think in general, as we've kind of aged, kind of used more technology to better kind of all kinds of production, we understand that we can't destroy every single thing. We have to renew it. You know, in my life, I look at the Bible and it says have dominion over the earth. It doesn't say destroy every living thing. It says have dominion. It's yours. Take care of it. You know, renew what you can renew. Use what you're going to use and renew it. So, anyway, Oregon's done a great job, you know, and yet the environmentalists have hindered logging so much in this state and really done some of the stupidest thing. You know, it's kind of funny. Every single week, I have my show notes in front of me, and every single week, I think of something else to talk about from my show notes. But this is what I was going to say. Unless I forgot, which is always a possibility. No, the environmentalists have restricted harvesting lumber so much and created an environment for massive freaking forest fires. Now, for all of you who don't live in Oregon, which I think is most everybody, there's a couple people here on Real Liberty Media that are from Oregon, but last year, we had the worst, maybe, the worst fire season to date. Like, I kind of think the Tillamook burn might have been bigger. That was about, what, 60, 70 years ago, something like that. I don't know, maybe more. It was before my time. But the reason that we had such a horrible fire season last year, it wasn't because of what loggers had done. You could clearly place the blame of these fires at the foot of environmentalists, and I'm going to explain why. So environmentalists don't want the environment messed with, okay? So what they've done is said, I mean, they kind of through years of negotiations have come up with some kind of compromise with loggers and the logging community and the logging industry, I guess. You know, the environmentalists didn't get everything they wanted, but they got some of what they wanted. And the and the lumber industry didn't get everything they wanted, but they got some of what they wanted. So the environmentalists said, okay, you can harvest the trees, but you have to reforest, and we don't want you taking out all that stuff that you drop on the ground. So all the tiny sticks, all the tiny limbs, all the parts of the tree that aren't going to go to the lumber mill to be processed, leave it on the ground, which is so flippin' stupid. So it used to be that you could get a permit to go collect firewood. And basically, you would get a permit from the Forest Service, and you would go into the forest at the area that they said, and you could cut up any stuff that was on the ground and harvest it for firewood and take it home and burn it in your fireplace or chimney or whatever. Well, the environmentalists didn't like that idea. They wanted everything just left on the ground. And why? I have no idea. I guess I've never looked into that part of the argument before. Maybe I will now to see what their reasoning for that was. But basically, so the loggers, they get to harvest logs, but they can't take all that. Number one, they wouldn't want to take all that debris out. But, you know, it's kind of like gleaning. Once you're done harvesting the fields, you let people come in and pick whatever fruit is left or vegetables or whatever. So, you know, all the fruit and vegetables gets used. You know, you take the good stuff and send it to market, and all the stuff that's left, you let people come in and take. I don't know if you're familiar with that idea, but it's pretty common practice in some cultures. But anyway, so the environmentalists leave this fuel, I call it, they leave the fuel on the ground. In fact, it's required that you leave the fuel on the ground and that you don't let people go in and you know, glean what's left. So there's a ton of fuel on the ground, basically nice dry firewood, especially about in August. And, you know, don't let people go in and clean it up. So you have this huge base of fuel on the ground. And trust me, if you've ever gone into one of these areas like a year after they've clear cut, it's harder than heck to walk around in because all of those branches are just piled on the ground. All the debris, all the limbs from the trees, all the bark is all just left on the ground. And any new shrubbery, greenery, first growth that's coming up, it's really unstable. I had to help a buddy take an elk out of a ravine one year, and we had to traverse some of that stuff. And I'm surprised nobody broke a leg going in or getting out of there. But I guess that's what the environmentalists wanted. I mean, I'm not so sure that they really thought long-term enough to understand that what they were doing is creating an excellent fire environment. But basically, that's what they have done, is they've created this environment where once you get a fire going, it's going to burn like crazy. And once it's kind of burned across that clear-cut area with all that nice dry fuel, it's going to burn up forest because, you know, you don't clear cut the entire forest. You clear cut some acreage, and then you have like this big wall of forest bordering it. So this is what happened last year. You know, a fire started. It was on what they call, I don't know what they call it. It was on federal forest land. You know, what's that? BLM, Bureau of Land Management. It was on BLM land, okay? So our stupid governor, Kate Brown, freaking idiot, and believe me, she's a power-hungry idiot, but she's an idiot. She didn't want to send any resources in to fight the fire because it was on federal land. Now, do you understand what I'm saying? So this was a fire in the state of Oregon, and the governor of Oregon basically had the feeling to just let it burn. you know, it's not her problem. Even though it's in her state, apparently because, you know, the federal government owns it, it's their problem. Well, that fire burned for weeks and just kept growing in size, and nobody went to put it out. And then we had those eastern winds blow in from the east. And I don't mean 20-mile-an-hour winds. I don't mean 40-mile-an-hour winds. I don't even mean 60-mile-an-hour winds. We had like 70 to 90-mile-an-hour winds just stoking the flames of that fire. And yeah, it spread everywhere. So it burned up, you know, a hell of a lot of Oregon. And it was very difficult to get to. It wasn't like, you know, you're just going to drive a bunch of fire trucks out there or water tankers or whatever. I mean, they were throwing everything they could at this fire, but they couldn't even, by the time they could get to it, I mean, you can imagine what a forest fire with 90-mile-an-hour winds does. If you've ever had like a little campfire going and then hooked up a vacuum cleaner backwards and blew air on that fire, and that's not 90 miles an hour, I can tell you that. You know what happens. I mean, it fuels that fire like to a raging furnace. And that's basically what happened here. And there was no way you could get, for one thing, the winds were so horrible, you couldn't fight it with aircraft. The smoke was so bad. I think visibility was horrible. I can't remember what else was going on at the time. There was either, I know there wasn't any rain, but there was some other something, well, COVID was hindering getting people, you know, on scene and getting enough firefighters to go in there and fight this fire, but it was so damn dangerous. I mean, they had to wait until, yeah, and rioting in Portland, yeah, and the smoke filled the valley, Willamette Valley. It was horrible. It was truly horrible. For weeks in the valley, we had smoke, and it smelled like, it smelled like somebody next door was having a campfire, and the smoke was so thick. I mean, I couldn't even see the town. I live on a hill, and town is 3 miles away, and I couldn't even see the town below through the smoke. It was really truly horrible, and you know, the bottom line is it was because of some really horrible policies. Many policies that environmentalists have created, or that an environmentalist, Kate Brown, decided she was just going to let nature take its course, I guess, and let the fire burn out unless the federal government came in and did something. And, you know, so what this is what happened. I remember this because I was going to go hiking that weekend. The weekend that it really blew out of control, the weekend that it was going, that I was going to go hiking, I look at the weather forecast and it's going to be like 100 and something. Now, I will be the first to admit that I am a sun pussy. I do not like heat. I really don't care much for the sun, but I've learned how to, I'm a ginger, by the way, redheaded, you know, freckled guy. So I don't tolerate the sun very well anyway. And all right, Cowboy Tech, we'll see you later. Oh, hey, there's Bear. He's putting in his 2 cents worth. Bear, quiet. Hey, oh, settle down. Easy, easy, easy. It's nothing. All right. You just wanted to be on the air, huh? Well, well, that was fun. You know, home studio, you never know what's going to happen, but he got on the air, so now he's part of the podcast. And that's the big dog. That's the one big dog we have. So, forgot what I was, what I was saying. But anyway, the bottom line is, yeah, we burned up. Oh, I know what I was saying. So that weekend, it was going to be 100 and something, and I was going to go hiking in the Cascades, which is basically where the fire was, and the area that I was going to hike was literally within a couple miles of where the fires were burning. But they started that weekend when I didn't go hiking. So, anyway, I just remember clearly that, you know, because of the heat, the wind, and then after that weekend, it just blew up out of control and, you know, we never recovered from it. Really, seriously, last year, it took forever before those fires were brought under control. And then this year, a lot of those areas that I plan to go hiking in are off limits. As a matter of fact, I might as well mention now, like this weekend, there won't be a live show for Redneck Dentist on Saturday because I am going hiking with my daughter. And the original trail we planned on going on is closed because of that ice storm we had about, I don't know, February, and it took down a lot of trees and stuff, so it's not open. But a lot of the trails that people have already explored, they say it's really hard to even follow the trail because there's so much burnt forest and trees on the trail. You know, if you go hiking, generally you'll come across one or two trees, but the trail leads right up to it, and you either go over or under or around, and then you continue on the trail. Some of these areas are so bad that you can't even follow the trail. There's so much timber down. And guess what? You think that loggers could go in and harvest that? Apparently not. At least originally they were saying no. They weren't going to let anybody go in and harvest those logs, even though they were only kind of like marshmallow roasted, you know, just on the outside. I mean, there's a lot of those trees that are still, you know, have plenty of lumber in them. But no, we're not going to let people go in and harvest that lumber. We're just going to leave it there on the ground to rot and decay and dry out, become nice, healthy forest fire fuel for whatever's coming next. And, you know, they say that mostly it's people who start those forest fires, but it's kind of funny how come every time a thunderstorm rolls through, they're always talking about how many fires were probably created by that thunderstorm. So, I don't know. I don't know if it's true or not. I know people are pretty irresponsible, I guess. I don't know. It seems like whenever I'm out hiking or camping, the people that I run into are always pretty damn responsible. But there's got to be some that aren't. I know, what, 3-4 years ago we had that teenager launch a firework in the freaking forest, and that was the Eagle Creek fire, I think, a few years ago here in Oregon, and yeah, he got in some pretty big trouble for that. In fact, they kind of made him responsible to pay back, I don't know, $39 million or $1 billion or something, and I'm sure he won't have to pay it all back, but it was the point of the thing, you know, to hold him responsible for it. But yeah, that fire burned out of control too, and that was pretty damn irresponsible. But most of the hikers I come across are fairly responsible. Like, you don't see a lot of trash on the trails or in little campsites. I mean, they do a really good job of packing out what they bring in, but not all of them. Some of them suck. Let's see, 15 minutes to go. Hey, did you guys... Oh, I want to get this story, and then I'm gonna give you a little something to ponder. I saw that. I'll read the first part. This is Dr. Fauci and the gain of function research. In a newly resurfaced paper from 2012, Dr. Anthony Fauci argued that the benefits of gain of function research are worth the increased risk of a potential pandemic-causing lab accident. Really? How about that? Dr. Fauci argued in 2012, 10 years ago, that the benefits of gain-of-function research are worth the increased risk of a potential pandemic-causing lab accident. Coincidence, I guess. Despite the risks involved, Fauci called gain-of-function experiments important work in his 2012 writing. Here's some of that writing. In an unlikely but conceivable turn of events, what if that scientist becomes infected with the virus, which leads to an outbreak and ultimately triggers a pandemic? Many ask reasonable questions. Given the possibility of such a scenario, however remote, should the initial experiments have been performed and or published in the first place? And what were the processes involved in this decision? And it says, scientists working in this field might say, as indeed I have said, that's Dr. Fauci talking, that the benefits of such experiments and the resulting knowledge outweigh the risks. Why? Like, why would the benefits of gain of function of a virus outweigh the risks? It would be interesting to know the answer to that question. It is more likely that a pandemic would occur in nature. Oh, that's interesting. He was making this argument in 2012. And the need to stay ahead of such a threat is a primary reason for performing an experiment that might appear to be risky. Well, how about that? Within the research community, many have expressed concern that important research progress could come to a halt just because of the fear that someone, somewhere, might attempt to replicate these experiments sloppily. And he says this is a valid concern. So, that was a Weekend Australian report. Adds that Fauci, the director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, did not alert senior White House officials before lifting a ban on gain-of-function research in 2017. In 2014, the Obama administration paused funding for gain-of-function experiments in 22 fields, including those involving SARS. That's kind of interesting, though. So, in other words, we had gain-of-function experiments in 22 fields. I wonder if a field is a virus, or if a field is a particular scientific department. But anyway, so SARS, influenza, and MERS, because of the increased risk of such experimentation, causing a pandemic. In other words, so they shut down gain-of-function experiments in 22 fields. In 2012, when Fauci authored the paper supporting gain-of-function research, there was a voluntary ban on such experiments related to highly infectious influenza viruses. Yet the EcoHealth Alliance diverted $600,000 in grants from the NIH. In other words, Fauci gave the EcoHealth Alliance $600,000, and they kind of diverted it to gain-of-function research. And specifically, in 2014 through 2019, for the purpose of studying bat coronaviruses. So, kind of funny that all of this stuff that Fauci has been arguing about for a year plus now, he kind of had time to rehearse this whole bunch of information. And by the way, that's what I was going to offer up. If you have not downloaded and read the SPARS Pandemic 2025 to 2028, is it a research paper? Let's see what it's actually called. A Futuristic Scenario to Facilitate Medical Countermeasure Communication. You really should take some time to go read that. And I was going to kind of make a list, and I didn't, of all of these kind of scenarios that have been created in the past that immediately led to exactly what they were, what they developed a scenario for. And I didn't do it, but I do remember like on 9/11, there was like this scenario. I think at the very same time 9/11 happened, they were kind of practicing this scenario for a massive terrorist attack like that. There's been other instances along the way. A matter of fact, I think even the most recent computer hacking scenarios have been, I mean, computer hacking events have had scenarios created where people could prepare for them. But what's interesting about this particular scenario and the report, and is that from Johns Hopkins? It is from Johns Hopkins University. You will hopefully, well, maybe you guys are smarter than me, so maybe you won't be surprised. But I was kind of taken by surprise reading the language in this very scenario. And this was done, I think this was done last year in March of 2020, but I could be wrong. Oh, yeah, date posted March 5th of 2020. Isn't that crazy? Okay, so there's going to be a link in the show notes for this very SPARS pandemic 2025 to 2028 scenario. I encourage you to read through it. It's not hard to read. It's pretty simple to read. It's, I think, in some ways eye-opening to see that the scenario addresses kind of everything we've seen in the last year. Like even down to people who don't want to get vaccinated and how they're going to sell that idea and what kind of responses they're going to have to people who don't want to get vaccinated. And I mean, it kind of, oh, it even addresses like minority groups and how they're going to react and how they're going to, how in this scenario are you going to win over the, you know, some of the minority communities and how you're going to talk to them to get them to understand how important it is that they follow, you know, kind of follow instructions and be good little sheeple and do what they're told to do. Really, it's an interesting, it really is an interesting scenario report from Johns Hopkins. You have to look at it in HTML or PDF, which is fine. I mean, just do it. Check it out. It'd be really interesting, I think, for you to just to see all of this stuff that was, I mean, this report was put out in March of 2020. Which, guess what happened in March of 2020? You all know, like the whole COVID thing kicked off and we're doing exactly what was in this scenario. And the government agencies and the hospital and the healthcare workers, et cetera, who have been on TV, who have been on the radio, who, you know, encourage you to do what you're told, are following this very script. Pretty amazing to see that in print. And then there was another one called Event 2021, I think it was, or Event 2001. I'll look it up. I'll put it in the notes too. I couldn't remember what that one was about, but that was something to do with Bill Gates. Can't remember what it was, but I'll try and find it and put it in the notes. But both of those things were both scenarios that were, you know, practiced and then came to fruition. So even though it says SPARS pandemic 2025 to 2028, yeah, event 201, event 201, that's what it's called. Thanks, Rob Works. So it kind of makes me a little bit concerned about what's coming in 2025, or if it was just that they kind of made this scenario in the future, but then it played out like immediately. Let's see, do I have time? We got 5 minutes. I'm going to try and get one more story in, and then I only have one story to carry over. That's kind of cool. Little drink. Yeah, okay, so this is kind of interesting. Happened right here in the great, good old United States of America. It says Ohio State University professor sentenced for using grant money. Zhang Songguo, a former professor at Ohio State University, pleaded guilty in November to lying on his National Institute of Health, NIH, grant applications in order to use $4.1 million in research grants to develop the fields of rheumatology and immunology for China. He was arrested last May in Anchorage, Alaska, as he was preparing to board a charter flight to China in an attempt to flee the United States. When taken into custody, he was carrying multiple items, including two laptops, three cell phones, several USB drives, several bars of silver, expired Chinese passports for his family, and deeds for property in China. It says the judge issued Zhang to pay more than $3.4 million in restitution to the NIH and about $413,000 to Ohio State University. And then I just wrote a comment. I said this is ironic. American research funding is provided by American taxpayer for the benefit of American society, not as an illicit gift to the Chinese government. Oh, this was the Assistant Attorney General John C. Demers. He said that, not me. It's too smart for me to have said that. For the Justice Department's National Security Division, it's like funding for gain of function of viruses to make viruses more infectious, adhere to respiratory cells stronger, and cause more harm, etc. All right, peeps. Thanks so much for joining me this evening. Thanks for listening to the podcast. Be sure and check out Real Liberty Media. Like I said, great shows on there, Grimner and Moose Girl, Hal Anthony, I'm going to forget everybody basically, but there's some great shows on there, Behind the Woodshed, I said that. Oh, and the music on Sunday is great, Circles on there with Grimner, what am I missing? I'm probably missing plenty. Hey, but anyway, you guys, thanks for joining me. I will see you probably next Tuesday, and we are out of here.